If everyone will take their seats, and so we can get started here in a second. Okay. All right, committee will come to order, and we do have a quorum present, I believe. So did Representative Nelson, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I move to approve the minutes.
Okay, Representative Nelson moves approval of the minutes for
portions of Minnesota's
February 2nd.
Election system took advantage of these
technological
developments.
No hearing, no discussion. All in favor of approval of the minutes of February 2nd, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion does prevail. First, I just want to start off with kind of my agenda for the day. We're going to be on a very tight schedule. And this is what I have in mind. First, we have House File 1, which I just want to point out has been through several committees, including Ways and Means, so I'm only allowing about 20 minutes. And the reason is because we only have to deal with basically one section of the bill. The very last section of the bill we have purview of here, and I will have Mark Shepard talk about that in a second. And then what we will do is hear the first photo ID House File 89 Benson. We will allow him to present his bill. We will lay it on the table. Then we will have Representative Kiffmeyer present House File 210. Then we will open it up to public testimony. We do have a rather lengthy list of testifiers. We will allow for 3 minutes per person. We'll time that and I just want all the members of the audience to know that if you go over 3 minutes, then you're going to be preventing other people from having their say. So try to be as succinct as possible. Then at the when we reach the noon hour, we will also lay the Kiffmeyer bill on the table. We will come back on Tuesday, at which time we will take member questions, deal with amendments, and allow the members or the authors of the bill to wrap up their comments, and we will vote at that time. So if all members are okay with that, I would prefer to hold off on any member questions and whatnot until the end. But Representative Nelson, did you have a question on that?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question, a clarification, if there are testifiers that are testifying today that will not or cannot be back next week, how are we going to be able to ask them questions? I mean, if they're here giving their 3 minutes and they're not going to be here next Tuesday when we have questions, how can we do that if they're not here?
Well, Representative Nelson, if a member feels very strongly that they need to ask a particular testifier a question, that would be okay if someone does feel that. But just please keep in mind that it's going to limit the time on additional testifiers. So I guess I'll kind of leave that to you if you feel that there's something you really strongly need to know from a witness. But keep in mind, most of the people are representing a group or representing their own opinion, and so they're not necessarily going to know the answer to any particular technical question anyway. So since we are limited with time, I'm going to go ahead and have Representative Fabian come down. And do we have someone who'd like to move Representative Fabian's bill?
Okay, so moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, I believe the motion is that House File 1 should be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. Is that correct?
Yes,
okay. So moved. At this time, I'm going to turn it briefly over to Mr. Shepard to explain what our purview is as a committee, and then I will turn it back over to you, if that's okay, Representative Fabian. Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and members, there's a House Rule 4.13 that requires certain bills to be re-referred to this committee before they get their second reading. One of the types of bills that has to be re-referred is a bill that either delegates rulemaking authority or exempts an agency from rulemaking authority. And in this bill, the last section, Section 11 on page 8, contains an exemption from the customary rulemaking authority. And I believe that is why the bill was a mandatory referral to this committee, Section 11 on page 8.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. Please proceed, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1 is a bill for me that is important in our state to streamline the processes that are involved in getting permits from MPCA and the DNR. I believe that it's a bill that is going to allow us to get our economy going more quickly. There's a tremendous amount of resources available to us in our local communities where we have the ability to be able to get these projects going quicker. That's going to allow for our local governments, our cities and counties, to save money in permitting fees. It's going to allow our businesses to save money. It's going to speed up the process. It's going to make this situation better, not just for businesses, but also for our local governments. And I think it's important. I applaud the governor. He has issued his administrative order to speed up this process. I think there's a broad agreement on the necessity of this. And with that, I would take questions. If we do have some questions about Section 11, I've talked to Mark Shepard. He can deal with the legalities involved in this process better than I can with regards to Section 11. So if you would direct your questions to him.
Members have any questions? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not in Section 11, although it does address a rulemaking provision in the bill, which is in Section 5, requiring that any state standards that exceed federal minimum standards require additional documentation to show why the federal standard is not adequate for Minnesota. And I guess my question to you, Representative Fabian, is it seems to me that if you are adding an extra layer of review for an agency to adopt a more stringent standard in this bill, it's not really a streamlining provision. It's a way of hampering the development of higher standards for environmental protection. So I wonder if you could address why that rulemaking provision is part of a streamlining process when it seems to add time and expense to the rulemaking process and, in fact, deals more with standards rather than speed of processing requests or permits.
Senator Fabian?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is also addressed in the governor's executive order. He feels the same way in his order as what the bill does. We are not necessarily asking for a lowering of standards. We are simply saying, why is this federal standard not good enough? Why does this not protect our environment? And you know, that's what we're trying to address there. I don't believe that it's going to slow down the process. I think that there are people involved in the agencies that can do this and get it done in a timely manner.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Winkler?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would just say that if you want them to meet the 150-day benchmark that you set out, then adding additional workload to make additional findings regarding the federal standards seems to me that that's counterproductive to the goal. As I understand the goal, anyway, it's to not change the standards, not to degrade environmental protection, but the goal is to make the process for getting a yes or a no from the agencies faster. And it seems to me you're just adding workload here and attaching Minnesota's environmental standards more to the federal standards without speeding anything up.
Senator Fabian.
Madam Chair, Representative, there again, I do believe that we can meet those goals. A part of the bill is to, in the streamlining, is that these are goals that are being set. They are not etched in stone. They are not mandates at this point. We're willing to work with the different departments to make sure that we figure out why some permits take longer, why some take less time, and see if we can't figure out what are the snags that occur in these things, and through a process be able to determine why they are taking longer to get done, and hopefully through that discussion with the departments and so forth and the proposers, we can get this process moving faster in the future.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Representative Fabian. Given the fact that we've had an executive order by the governor, and we are now awaiting a legislative auditor's report due the end of February, it appears to me that this bill is maybe a little bit out of order. And I put that in context that we have a highly respected legislative audit process in the House of Representatives. And I know that I follow these guidelines that the legislative auditor issues to us, and we work them very hard, and they're nonpartisan people. I would like to wait for the legislative auditor's report and then construct legislation that would maybe highlight what the auditor has discovered through their nonpartisan research of the issues in the state of Minnesota. And why have you chosen to go before that, and would you be open to waiting for the legislative auditor's report so that we could see all the facts laid out?
Madam Chair, please state your name, the tape, and everything.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy here at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and represent, along with Mike Robertson, my colleague, the Chamber here at the Capitol on environmental issues. Representative Winkler, to step back for a second to your question, we're just taking the regular APA process and putting it into the PCA statutes there to have them look at as they go through a state-by-state comparison and ask us why, if you're going to be tougher than federal standards, and there are going to be instances where we are going to be tougher than federal standards. We're blessed with an abundance of natural resources in this state of 10,000 lakes, Class 1 wilderness area, two national parks, and Lake Superior. So there are going to be instances where we're going to be tougher. We're just asking that the reasons why we're going to go, when you're in the APA Act, to do that. And then a state-by-state comparison around that. Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, we agree with Commissioner Austin, who's testified before Representative McNamara's committee, as well as over in the Senate and a couple committees over there, that this is a process that we're looking to rid of duplication and overlap. And if you'll nip and tuck, if you will, the environmental review and environmental permitting process. It is crucial that we protect the public health and the environment and natural resources of this state. But we think through efficiencies in the system, and we agree with Commissioner Austin that this, he's identified kind of a four-step process. Number one was the governor's executive order, and we thank him for identifying the priorities that we have identified also and putting them into an executive order and moving them forward. Number two, Commissioner Austin identified as House File 1 and Senate File 42 as being the next step in the process. Number three would be, I agree with you. I'm not sure if I could find somebody that's got a lot more respect than Legislative Auditor Nobles in here, and I am sure he's going to do a great job with about the 14 case studies that he has done. And then number four, Commissioner Austin mentioned about convening stakeholders, the business community, the people in state agencies, as well as environmental organizations to get together to see if there's some areas of mutual consent of people that use the process that we can move forward again to see if we can go, you know, technology has changed over the last 5, even 10 years. The access to information is so quick, which is why you also see, to get off track again real quick, Madam Chair.
Please try to wrap up your comments. We are moving.
So that's Representative Scalzi, why we're going to keep moving forward with this.
Representative Scalzi.
Just as a follow-up, I'm anticipating that there will be additional legislation coming out after the legislative auditor's report, and I guess I just would choose to wait for that because I want to see all the facts on the table. I've studied this extensively, but I would like to see if there's additional legislation coming out after that, and I think there will be. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fabian, in Section 8, you have a provision around environmental review in which the basically the proposer of a particular project, the entity causing the pollution, as it were, would now be doing the environmental impact statement as opposed to a more objective third party. And so my question is, how does that enhance the environment if you have basically the polluter doing the environmental review? It's kind of a fox guarding the hen house scenario. And so I'm interested in your thoughts about that. And secondly, environmental review, the environmental impact statement process, does have very specific areas in which the public can participate. And so how would the public be participating in your new scenario? So two questions. Is the fox guarding the hen house, and how's the public going to be engaged in this?
Representative Fabian.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, no, the fox is not going to be guarding the hen house. Excuse me. What we're trying to do here is allow for better communication between the proposer, whether it's a company, whether it's a city or a county, to deal directly with consultant who's putting together the EIS. The data that's collected in the EIS still has to meet the standards. It still has to be reviewed by the responsible government units. We are not sidetracking anything in terms of environmental standards. We're simply trying to increase communications between proposers and consultants who put the EISs together and hopefully gather good, responsible, solid data that's going to be able to withstand review by the responsible government unit.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Quick follow-up. So you talked about proposers and consultants. Where does the public then weigh in this process?
Well, excuse me. So you have, Madam Chair, Representative, you still have the 150 days to gather the data and so forth, put that together. Then also there is the 30-day review time at the end, and all these documents are available for review. That would be the time that the public is going to be involved. And you still have to meet the reviews.
Thank you.
Okay. Looks like we don't have further questions. Okay. Do you have any words to wrap up, Representative Fabian?
No, okay. Madam Chair, I do not. Thank you.
All right. Well, Representative McFarland will renew her motion that House File 1 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Please say no.
No.
Motion prevails. We'll quickly move on to... If everybody could just stay quiet so we can proceed in an orderly fashion. We will now proceed to House File 89. And again, the intention is to have Representative Benson introduce his bill, and then we will lay it on the table so we can hear the differences of his bill with Representative Kiffmeyer's bill, who's got a similar one. Did I say lay it on the table? Lay it over. Sorry. Good point. Okay. Was Representative Riddle? Did anyone have a motion for Representative Benson?
Yeah.
Representative Quam.
I would move that we... pass forward this
state government finance.
State to the state government finance.
Okay. Representative Quam moves House File 89 be recommended to pass and re-referred to state government finance. Okay, on to you, Representative Benson.
Thank
you,
Madam Chair and committee members. I'd also want to mention that I have a author's amendment to the bill.
Okay. Representative Quam, would you like to move the amendment? Looks like, is it the...
Yes, I would. It's amendment H0089A1. Would like to move that.
Okay, Representative Quam moves the H0089A1 amendment. would you like to explain your amendment first, or...?
Yes, thank you, okay. Madam Chair. There are some inserts to the bill that I want to explain. Just further clarification. Page 2, line 10, after the period insert, if an applicant is unable to provide proof of current registration as required in Clause 1, the application must still be accepted if the statewide voter registration system indicates that the applicant is registered and eligible to vote in Minnesota. That's an opportunity for those who, when you register for the first time, you'll get notification of the fact that you are now a registered voter in the state of Minnesota. If you were to somehow lose that, and you still go now until to get at the county auditors your free voter ID and you don't have that with you, they won't turn you away. They will look first in the data bank to make sure that you're a registered voter before they would make you go through the process of re-registering. Page 2, line 20, after the contain insert, a barcode suitable for scanning. This is... an opportunity for the cards. These cards, the voter ID cards that are mentioned in the bill, are permanent. There's no expiration date on it. This is an attempt to make sure that in the future, if new automated equipment is deployed that can read barcodes, that the process could be speeded up. Barcodes similar to what's on the driver's license. So this is an attempt from the very beginning to account for the deployment of additional equipment in the future. The last one, it's Subdivision 1 Notice of Registration. The important part, of course, underlined, except where required by paragraph B, and B is the change. The notice provided in paragraph A must be sent upon acceptance of registration application from a voter who has not been previously registered to vote in Minnesota. In addition to the requirements of paragraph A, a notice sent to a voter under this paragraph must inform the voter of the requirements for voting in the polling place, including the photo identification requirements contained. Rather than going through all that, this is an explanation to say, for example, if you have a student out of state that comes in and registers to vote, or registers to vote or changes their address but does not go in to get a new driver's license in the state, this is a requirement that the state must tell them that at some point between the time they move in and they've registered, that they have to get a photo ID that is ID that is compliant with this bill.
Okay, thank you. My intention would be to, if anyone has specific questions on how the amendment fits into the regular, to House File 89, I would take those. Otherwise, I would like to go ahead and vote on the author's amendment only at this point. Okay. All those in favor of the H0089A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Okay, amendment does pass. Did you want to now go on and explain the rest of your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
It's a civic duty, arguably a patriotic duty, for every citizen, eligible citizen, voter, to exercise their right to choose the people they wish to represent them. It's the state's responsibility, Madam Chair, to make sure that, that the system that is used to collect those votes is one that provides integrity in the system, and that the voters can be reasonably assured that the vote that they cast will actually count for something. Not to go through all the bill, I know that this is a short time today and that we're going to reconvene on Tuesday to discuss it more, where there'll be more questions. And I'm not going to read the entire bill, but to summarize it, the bill requires voters to show voter identification before receiving a ballot at the polling place. It provides a process for voters who do not have a photo identification card to receive one free of charge at the county auditor. It provides standards for provisional balloting for a voter who is unable to present photo identification on election day. Madam Chair and committee members, you need a photo ID to buy alcohol, cigarettes, drive a car to the polling place. We don't let people pick up an item at a store by pointing to it and saying, that's me. You have to show some proof of who you are, or that you are who you say you are. I've got numerous letters over the last week or two since the bill came out from people citing additional examples. I had a person who took their 14-year-old daughter last weekend, weekend before last, to take their ACT test, and they got to the school and were turned away because they didn't have a photo ID of a 14-year-old to take the ACT test. Yes, we have all heard the talking points that there are only 38 felons were prosecuted for fraudulently voting in the last election. Felons who are still under sentence who are not qualified to vote. Felons voting isn't the issue. It's pretty easy to find those fraudulent voters because they're documented. Letting people to vote without photo ID creates the ideal conditions, however, for fraud, undetectable fraud. There is no other way to discover how many people who are unqualified for other reasons because they have already voted or because they are registered to vote in another state or are voting fraudulently if no one has to produce any form of identification. It is, in fact, very easy to impersonate someone if you don't have to prove who you are. Voter fraud is not a victimless crime. If our voting process lacks integrity, legitimate votes will be diluted and voters will see the process as invitably, it will be without integrity and the outcomes suspect. Minnesota has a great tradition of high voter turnout. We've had some very close elections in the last couple of election cycles. And more you hear questions about the real integrity of the system. We need our elections to be seen as free and fair In order to do that, we need to have the processes in place that ensure that each vote is tied to an actual individual who lives in a particular place. And this can be all verified by a secure form of photo ID. Vouching is a poor substitute for verifying someone's identity. I know that there's a case right now of, in the last election, of people voting in Hennepin County, or vouching for people in Hennepin County. There's usually no proof that it is obtained at the polls. There is usually no proof that is obtained at the polls that the voucher actually knows the person or knows where they live. The vast majority of voters will have an ID and can produce it to vote. A smaller group of voters will have to be accommodated to get an ID in order to vote, and for that reason, my bill has a system of provisional voting that will allow people without an ID to vote on election day or to acquire an ID before election day. We've heard the ridiculous estimates about what it would cost to get this smaller group a photo ID, and those estimates are based on what it would cost to give each of those people a driver's license. A state ID is much less costly than a driver's license. It never needs to get renewed, and we already qualify some people for a reduced rate for obtaining one. These are the people who would probably seek an ID in those circumstances in order to have one to vote. Madam Chair and committee members, 26 states already require some form of ID to vote. 8 of those require a photo ID. It's no secret that this bill mirrors a lot of the language contained in the Indiana bill that has passed the muster through the Supreme Court of the United States. In poll after poll, the public consistently sides with voter ID, and in Minnesota that and around the country. More recently, a Rasmussen poll, August 2, 2010, reported that 82% say voters should be required to show a voter ID. And I know there's a reporter from my hometown paper today in the audience, and she represents the Pulse Bulletin. And I know that there was a pro-con opinion editorial for and against photo ID, and they took an impromptu poll of readers. And that poll showed 91% of the readers of the Rochester Post Bulletin who responded to the poll responded favorably that we need a photo ID. You know, in the vernacular of my children in a younger day, they would say, "Dad, this is a duh thing. This is a common sense thing. It's as much as common sense as when I left my room this morning, I knew it was going to be cold outside, so I put my coat on." That's how common sense voter ID is for the election process. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Babian. Excuse me, thank you, Representative Benton. I'd also like to note, I know there's going to be a lot of strong emotions one way or the other, and if we could hold off on clapping, cheering, booing, all that stuff, it's going to make the committee process go much faster. At this time, the Chair will lay over House File 89 as amended until next week, and I will have Representative Kiffmeyer come up and present her bill for consideration. Welcome to the committee, Representative Kiffmeyer. I believe Representative Erdahl has a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 210 to pass and be referred to the State Government Finance and laid over here.
You have to make that motion. I decide that.
Oh, well, I thought you were I thought you just told me to.
Representative Erdahl moves that House File 210 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State Government Finance. Do you have an author's amendment that you need to address, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do. House file, it's H-O-210-DE-1. It's the DE-1 amendment. It's a delete all.
Okay. I'll interrupt you here. Since it is a delete all amendment, that's quite lengthy. My thought would be to go ahead and pass this amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. That's agreeable to members? Okay, all those in favor of the DE-1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion passes, and the DEI 1 amendment does pass. And Representative Kiffmeyer, if you could now present the bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members of the State Government Operations Elections Committee, and to all of the observers we have here today, to all of you, welcome. I really appreciate Representative Mike Benson's presentation, and I anticipated that some of the points he would make would be covered. And it is something that I think the 91% of the Rochester Post Bulletin readers in support of voter ID as the most recent poll, increasing numbers, demonstrates the strong support. My bill that you have before you today is also about photo ID. The difference in my bill, though, is that it uses the Department of Public Safety to issue the photo IDs, also free. And also that then we use, that also includes in it the electronic rosters that are able to make use of some of the benefits, some of the technology that we have today. It's interesting that we use technology on the end of the process when we are counting the ballots. As an election judge for 11 years myself, we would sit till 5 or 6 in the morning hand counting the ballots. And wonderfully, over the years, while I was Secretary of State, we were able to work together and to have equipment that now, for the most part, election judges are done by about 10 o'clock at night, and also the state reporting system. So it's been fun to be part of that, to see that implemented, and now today to be for you, that the issue here is one of the beginning of the process, where we have voter registration, where we have checking in on election day, and to use some of the same technology principles that we have today, a simple laptop, a card reader, a simple printing mechanism, that will help take some of the burden off of the election judges and some of our county administrators and bring us into the 21st century in regards to how we initiate the process of casting a ballot. What's especially good about this particular bill is that it's modeled on the Indiana law, not exactly on the implementation of who issues the photo ID, but it's modeled on the principles of the Indiana law, the free IDs and the provisional ballots. And matter of fact, what's especially good to know is that modeled on those principles, it's already been ruled constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court and also ruled constitutional by the Indiana State Supreme Court twice. So when you have the U.S. Supreme Court, that in all their hearing and all of the research that they did, there was not one case of documented instance of people who were denied their right to vote because of the requirement of a photo ID. Now, you will hear some of the fears and all that kind of thing, but I think we should pass this bill on the confidence of the actual facts that are in front of us in regards to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, implementing these bills are very important, and how we do them is very important. So having met with other administrators, having been the chief elected official, I think that very aware of the importance of making sure they work through that smoothly. And so we will be continuing to work with them on any areas that we need. So I want to assure you that on some of those administrative implementation things that we will certainly do that. You know, the public deserves to have confidence, and not because we say so, but because when they go on the polling place on election day, that what they experience is something that inspires confidence with them in the process. Accuracy, integrity, and privacy are four principles of a strong election system, and they should be in balance with one another. One of members one time said to me that, well, some people just care about access and others just care about integrity. And I said, I want access with integrity. I want them both. We do them together. Chaos is not a word that should be used in describing elections. It should be orderly and conducted in an orderly process. It is just simply common sense to require this. I thought one of the most interesting things that I heard is a panel discussion in Washington, D.C., and on a variety of election issues. And one of the testifiers at that time was Andrew Young, former African-American mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. And he was asked the question, do you support voter ID requirement? And I waited carefully to listen to his answer. And he said, absolutely, I do support photo ID. I absolutely do support it. Matter of fact, he said, I consider it a disenfranchisement to not require it. And he went on to explain that those who have not have their own ability to get a regular ID card, have a vulnerability, but also they don't have the tool, that ID tool, that gives them the ability to engage with the economic process within their communities. It gives them that independence that says, I am here. I have an ID. I can go start a bank account. I can do things. I can cash checks. I can do things. I now have this ID. So not only for voting, they get to stand with their ID and say, I'm here to vote. I'm proud of it. I'm here to vote. And I took my responsibility, and I have my ID, and I am here to stand on my own 2 feet and to come and vote. I think that's an important component of the value of our citizens to be able to independently express their voice in the privacy of who they vote for, but also in having the tool as they come to vote. These are important issues, and we certainly need to deal with that. I'd like to talk also about the electronic rosters. What's really especially good is they have some significant value. But I thought that today, it's a little bit difficult. It's kind of like learning to cook and only reading the cookbook. We have home ec and we have a lab. You know, we don't learn carpentry by reading a book on carpentry. We get some wood and saws and we practice it. So I really appreciate where I had a person who offered to me and decided to put together just a short 10-minute video that would kind of document and describe what this might be like. And so, Madam Chair, this has been queued up, and they are ready today to go ahead and play this video, if that's okay with you.
That's fine. Representative Kiffmeyer, will you then be done with your presentation?
I will just wrap up with a few remarks.
Okay, thank you.
While we're waiting, Madam Chair, I think one of the important parts that I know will be in this video, but is also something, have any of you ever stood in line and you're in the long line? A through K, the middle letters, the end letters. Sometimes it's A through K, sometimes A through M. You're never quite sure, and you're trying to find the line that you want to go into. Not only with the electronic rosters do we have some checking in that works out really well, but we are also able to use this technology with a printer, and that we are able then to have a receipt that is printed with the ID number, and you sign the receipt. It kind of clears up that issue. But one little extra piece of that, what if you're in the wrong precinct? And now you got to figure out how to go to the other precinct. So they are able to print out a map using some very simple technology that will take you from the precinct where you are at to the one that is the correct one. So there's some real technology that we can work on here.
Ready?
We'll save it for Tuesday. Now, one of the problems, if you've ever queued up some PowerPoint presentations or things, that when you have a pause.
A lot changed during the 20th century. Advancements in technology enabled dramatic improvements in terms of the speed, cost, and quality of business and government operations. Portions of Minnesota's election system took advantage of these technological developments, including how voter registration records were stored and how ballots were tabulated. However, much of today's election system still remains an early 20th century. A 21st century voter ID bill has been introduced in the Minnesota.
Let's try to keep it quiet. What's your?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We like will save the video for Tuesday, Madam Chair.
We'll see if Rory can figure it out here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beard.
While I'm waiting, just an observation. I remember, I think it was two election cycles ago, we had passed the legislation authorizing the expenditure of the new handicapped accessible voting machines. And when I went to my precinct to vote, the election judge was so excited she had me vote in that machine. It ate three of my ballots in a row before they finally gave up and let me just go to the booth and do my regular thing. The point being that technology is a marvelous thing once we get it debugged and worked out. Now they're sailing through very smoothly. But that first one, I don't know whether it was the curl of the paper or what, but it was quite untimely. So just a little humorous insight into sometimes with the best of intentions we have to debug stuff. But since then, I'm proud to say that the precinct machine in my area hasn't eaten a single ballot. It's counted them all.
So. Glad to hear that it's working properly now. Is it working or?
Madam Chair, it's the technology of the House here as far as its interaction with the laptop, and the folks were in the room here ahead of time and everything was all set to go, but if they just made us something here was...
of Minnesota's elections. Let's take a moment and compare today's election system to some of the changes...
Representative Nelson.
A lot changed during the 20th century. Advancements in technology enabled dramatic improvements in terms of the speed, cost, and quality of business and government operations. Portions of Minnesota's election system took advantage.
My recommendation, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think that Representative Nelson. And no cutting me off now. I think that Representative Nelson's right that we should probably move forward with testimony. That would be okay with you?
And yes, Madam Chair.
We'll allow you to do this on Tuesday?
Yes, if there's an opportunity to do that. Just want to close with saying that we will be looking forward to seeing you again on Tuesday and appreciate the time that we've had here today. Thank you.
Okay, with that, at this time, the Chair will lay over House File 210 as amended until next Tuesday probably. Yeah. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to go back and forth. We've got a lengthy list of testifiers, both for and against. I'm going to start out with a couple of proponents, then we'll do the opposition, and we'll try to get a couple people on deck so we can save as much time as possible. If there's anyone else you need to get a note to Roy, the committee administrator here, we will start with Dan McGrath, and who's next? And Mike Dean. I guess we've got one proponent and one opponent. Which one are you doing first? Okay, we'll start with Dan McGrath, and then if we can have Mike Dean on deck.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for inviting me to testify on this issue that's very close to my heart.
Okay.
I'll be reading a prepared statement, and I have copies available for committee members, as well as an article in the Star Tribune that touches on the poll book system that...
I need to interrupt you for just a second. Could you please identify yourself for the tape? And I do want to remind everyone, 3 minutes, and we do have... Ryan will be letting you know when your time's running down, so we'll
start
from
now. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dan McGrath, Executive Director of Minnesota Majority. As Executive Director of Minnesota Majority, I've devoted a lot of time and energy towards researching Minnesota's election system over the past couple of years. What I've found is concerning. We've been told time and time again that Minnesota's election system is a model for the nation, but if that's true, I think we've got big problems, and I hope that other states don't adopt our election system. Combining election day voter registration with vouching creates an environment that voters don't and shouldn't trust. There's only one other state in the union that has an election system so wide open, and that's Iowa. And I believe they modeled their election system after ours, mistakenly. I want to make myself available to this committee to answer questions. I understand you're not going to be asking testifiers questions today, but I will come back Tuesday to be a resource if this committee so desires. For today, I want to focus on two significant problems that Minnesota Majority's research has revealed. Those are unverified voters and ineligible voters. Both are addressed and corrected by the changes proposed to our election law in House File 210. From information obtained through Data Practices Act requests to the Secretary of State's office, we determined that nearly 5% of Election Day registrations in 2008 provided information that could not subsequently be verified as true and correct. The process of verification involves postal verification cards, commonly known as PVCs. The PVC is a postcard that's delivered to every new registrant. If it's successfully delivered, the voter's information is assumed valid. But if it's returned as undeliverable mail, the voter is flagged for challenge at the next election. PVCs may be returned for one of three reasons: no such person at the voter's registered address, no such address, or the address is undeliverable, like it was not a residential property. Of about 500,000 election day registrations in 2008, over 23,000 of them were subsequently flagged for challenge because of a return PVC card. Bear in mind, this is after the votes have been counted. Our current election day registration rules essentially put less responsible voters at the front of the line. Election day registrants are not subject to the same scrutiny as voters who register in advance of an election. It's an injustice to grant preferential treatment and trust to some voters just because they decide to register to vote at the very last minute, and it's made worse when we learn that people may be abusing that trust. Of the 2 million voters who registered in advance of the election in 2008, about 15,000 PVC cards were returned undeliverable. Contrast that with 23,000 from 500,000 election day registrations. Clearly, election day registrations are a problem, but they don't have to be. In fact, there's an easy solution. With 21st century voter IDs proposed in House File 210, election day registrants will be subject to the same scrutiny as voters who register in advance of the election. Minnesota Majority's research, you've probably also heard a bit about the felons that we've discovered. This is another issue that's addressed by House File 210. Ineligible voters will be detected at the polling place by computerized database match. And the process is much more efficient, cost-effective, and it's going to create greater convenience for the voters. Thank you for taking the time to hear my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Next, we will have Mike Dean, and then after that, we'll hear from the League of Women Voters. I think there's three that would like to speak: Gwen Myers, Mary Lou Hill, and Jessica Peterson. Mike Dean.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota, a government reform organization. And I'm here to testify in opposition to both pieces of legislation. Our country was founded on the belief that every citizen has the right to vote. It's a right that thousands of Americans have fought for, died for, and should not be taken away. Mandating a government-issued identification card to vote will do just that. It will hurt the elderly, the young, preventing them from casting legally allowed ballots because of bureaucratic red tape. We should be making it easier for citizens to vote, like making it easier for soldiers to vote overseas and cast their ballot, which this legislation actually would make it more difficult for them to vote, not making it harder. At a time when Minnesotans can't find jobs and our budget is in shambles, we need our elected officials to fix those problems, not try to impose more rules and regulations on a system that is not broke. The mandates in this legislation will cost taxpayers over $40 million. It will not be cheap to create and distribute the IDs to those that don't have them, impose a provisional balloting system that has been disastrous in other states, and purchase all the new equipment for electronic poll books. This does not make sense when we could have improved the integrity of our election system and saved taxpayers money by implementing the registration modernization bill that Governor Plenty vetoed last year. Registration modernization is recognized by election officials as a cost-effective way to improve the integrity of our election system. Moreover, this idea has bipartisan support. Just a few weeks ago, the Pew Center for the States recognized the bipartisan work of Governor Herbert of Utah for modernizing the registration process in Utah. In a press release on January 13th of this year by Governor Herbert, the Pew Center for the States Managing Director said, "Thanks to Governor Herbert and Lieutenant Governor Bell and other state leaders, Utah is pioneering the way that states should dramatically increase the accuracy, efficiency, and cost-effectiveness of the registration system. I urge legislators to follow the lead of Utah's governor by working together to find bipartisan ways to improve our election system instead of wasting time playing partisan politics." Thank you.
Thank you. I think the League of Women Voters next.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Just so in case there's somebody that can't, that's testifying, that if they can identify, if they're not going to be back Tuesday for questions, if they could say that so that if somebody here has questions on either side, we can get them asked.
Okay, fair enough. If anybody cannot be here on Tuesday that feels that they need to be available for testimony, answering questions, please identify yourselves when you testify. Okay. Please be sure to state your name and association for the record. And up next will be David Maida from Minnetonka.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gwen Myers. I am a board member of the League of Women Voters and a volunteer lobbyist. I've also been an election judge for the past 10 years since I retired. The League believes that voting is a constitutional right that must be guaranteed in our democracy. Our 90-year-old organization was created by people, women, who were denied the right to vote until 1920, so we know what it's like to be shut out of the system. We have a special affection for suffrage. There are two things the League considers when reviewing proposals to change our election law. First, does this change make the election process more accessible and less intimidating to voters? And second, will this change exclude any group of citizens from the election process? When these questions are posed about Representative Kiffmeyer's and Representative Benson's bills, the League gets the wrong answers. Along with being costly to implement and completely unnecessary, these bills will deny the vote to United States citizens by adding to the difficulty of same-day registration and by requiring registered voters to provide a current government-issued photo ID. And they will exclude some very specific groups. With me today are two League members who will illuminate some aspects of our objection to House File 89 and House File 210. Mary Lou Hill and Jessica Peterson-White. We'll start with Mary Lou.
Thank you. Please state your name and for the record.
Mary Lou Hill, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Members of the committee and Madam Chair, I'm Mary Lou and I'm 94 years old. I was born in November of 1916, 4 years before the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. After just 70 years of unremitting effort on the part of women and men across this country, I learned about this struggle from my mother and my aunts who raised me in the Bryn Mawr area of Minneapolis. Soon after I reached the age of 21, in 1937, I registered to vote. It was like a rite of passage to full citizenship. Soon after that, I joined the League of Women Voters. I believe the right to vote is among our most important rights. For this reason, I urge you to oppose House File 89 and House File 210. Whatever the author's intentions, the effect of these bills will be to take the vote away from United States citizens by putting obstacles in their path to the voting booth. Requiring a government-issued photo ID from registered voters before they're allowed to vote will disenfranchise thousands of senior citizens. It is easy for one of you to run down to the government center and to update your driver's license or to get a Minnesota ID. Senior citizens may have a number of problems with this simple activity. They may not drive and may not have anyone to take them. They may not be able to walk without pain or at all. If they are new to the state, they may have difficulty proving who they are. This is especially true for elderly women who have probably changed their names once or twice since they were born. One story, when she moved back to Minnesota, a friend wished to get a Minnesota ID card. She took the following to the Hennepin County Government Center: her birth certificate, her Arizona driver's license, her military ID, and her passport. It was not enough. Her name had changed since she was born. They wanted her marriage license. Fortunately, she'd been married in Hennepin County, and they found the license in their records. If she'd been married in Phoenix, she'd have been dealing with some office in Arizona state government and paying for a copy of her marriage license. You've all heard this. The statistics, 18% of people over the age of 65 do not have a current government-issued photo ID. That percentage must escalate rapidly as the age is increased. How many 94-year-old women do you suppose have a current photo ID? There's no question that these bills will disenfranchise thousands of elderly citizens, citizens who have been proudly casting their ballots for 50 or 60 or 70 years. I urge you to vote no on House File 89 and House File 210. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Ellen. Thank you for making the effort to come in here. I will point out that I do believe that you're not coming back on Tuesday, so if members do have any questions for you, perhaps you could sit for a moment, and then we'll wait till after the final League testifier, and then if we do have any questions for Ms. Hill in particular. Thank you. Please proceed and state your name for the tape.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Jessica Peterson-White. I was a lead election judge in Northfield during the last two elections, and I'm a member of the League of Women Voters. I'm speaking today in opposition to the provisions in HF 210 that eliminate vouching as a means of voter registration. Vouching allows a registered voter of the same precinct who has personal knowledge of another citizen's residency in that precinct to legally affirm that person's residence for purposes of Election Day registration. This provision has been allowed in Minnesota since 1973. As election judges, we are careful to ensure that only personal knowledge of another's residence is ever used as the basis for vouching. The polling place where I work has multiple assisted living and nursing facilities, and residents of these facilities are a great example of why the vouching system is so important. On election day, we find that many elderly voters in the precinct have moved into a new facility since the last election, often from an assisted living unit to a skilled nursing unit at the same facility. As election judges, we must make sure that they are registered to vote at their new address, even though this address may be only across the street or next door to the address of their previous registration. They travel to the polling place on election day, often overcoming serious physical limitations, and they find they need to re-register. Many do not have a phone, a utility bill, a lease, or a driver's license bearing their current address. They are vouched for by a fellow resident or an employee of the facility where they live. This is a population who are extremely committed to voting. They work hard to make it to the polling place. As election judges, we try to ensure they can exercise their franchise as they've done all of their lives. Last November, we would have been forced to turn away many elderly citizens if vouching were not an option. Students in Northfield also register to vote by having someone vouch for them. Some live in off-campus housing in groups and do not have utility bills in every housemate's name. They receive other mail at their campus mailboxes. Because they often are from other states, the state does not require them to get Minnesota driver's licenses when they are not permanent full-time residents. So they, too, would have been turned away from our polling place had they not been able to register through vouching. I do not believe that there are any instances of improper vouching for students in Northfield's polling places where we have a large student population. Election judges go in and out of the polling places, and the city clerk, staff, and other officials often stop by so that we are always aware of what is going on outside the polling place. As election judges, we feel responsible for the integrity of our election system. I am confident that the vouching system enhances that integrity.
Thank you. And I'll open up for questions for Ms. Hill if there are any. But first, on deck, Wayne Carrier. Okay, and then Teresa Nelson. Did anybody have any questions in particular for Ms. Hill before she leaves? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Wayne Carrier, could, oh, yes, Representative Beard.
Ms. White might be back on Tuesday, is that correct?
Ms. White? Ms. Peterson?
And the one that just testified, Mrs. will she be back on
Tuesday? Oh, Peterson White. Oh, yes.
Couple questions.
Will you be back on Tuesday?
I don't believe I will be.
Oh.
Okay. Do you have a specific question, Representative Beard? Okay. Could you come back for a quick question?
Yes. Perhaps. Would you like me to stay?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Ready? Yes. Madam Chair, Ms. White. You testified that you're a judge in Northfield where you deal with a lot of college students.
Mm-hmm.
Those college students happen to have picture IDs. Do they have to register with the college where they attend and actually prove who they are and that they have the right to be the student there?
Ms. Peterson-White.
They do, but they don't need to demonstrate their residence, which is the basis of voter registration. So they often... They are often, in fact, encouraged to retain their driver's licenses in their home states because they're likely to go back there ultimately, but are encouraged to vote in Minnesota because they will be a resident for 30 days before the election. And so it's more appropriate often than voting in their home states. So they do need to have photo ID, but they don't have to have photo ID that demonstrates their current location, their residence.
Well, Madam Chair, just a follow-up observation. I don't believe the bill requires that they have to have that. There has to be some sort of a credible photo ID, and I think a college identification that they're actually matriculating at the college in the neighborhood they're voting in is would probably meet that test or easily be amended into the bill. So anyhow, just an observation. It doesn't seem to be too strenuous or overbearing to require students to actually prove who they are and where they're matriculating when they show up at a precinct to vote. So just an observation about the... No, just an observation.
Thank you. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, I, What happens at the polling place, in fact, is that students appear, and if they may have all of their bills and things sent to their campus address, but that's not actually where they live. And as election judges, we work really hard to ensure that people are voting in the right place. So if they get their mail on campus at St. Olaf but live across the street, they should vote at their address across the street, which in Northfield is a different precinct. So the question is not whether they can prove that they are who they say they are, but that they can prove that they live where they say they live.
Thank you. And we'll take Representative Nelson has a question, but I do want to remind members I would really prefer to keep the vast majority of questions for Tuesday, because otherwise we're not going to get through all the list of people that want to testify today. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think she answered the question I had about, I was going to ask whether the student ID identifies where they live. It just identifies that they're a student at the school, and she answered that question.
Precisely, yes. And we do receive often... currently, the Secretary of State's office allows us to accept a list that the college submits to the polling places of the students who reside in dormitories, but that the college can't provide us with proof of residence for students who live off campus, who are a few but equally entitled to vote. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move on to Wayne Carrier.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. Mine is very simple. You're not going to have to hold up the time.
Excuse me. Please just remember to state your name for the record, and then if you're representing any
Wayne
group.
Wayne Carrier is my name. I live in Orono, Minnesota, and I've been an election judge close to 25 years. I haven't missed any of the elections. Actually, my first vote was for Eisenhower. My point is this. In Orono, it's pretty calm as a rule in the voting poll and polling place, but 20 to 25% of the people that came in to vote in the last several elections automatically take out their driver's license and show it. And I've never had any objection to anybody using an ID. In fact, they all encourage the use of ID, and that's, I think, some of them making a statement by showing their caller ID, even though it's not required by law. They still think that it's a good idea, as I do, and I've never heard of anybody in our polling place ever object to it. And that's all I have to say, madam.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We'll move on to Teresa Nelson.
Madam Chair.
Hold on just a second. And then Lucky Rosenblum. Is Lucky here? Okay, then who's next? Then Walter Hudson would be next. Thank you. Please proceed and please state your name for the record and any association you have.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal counsel for the ACLU of Minnesota. We're funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. Our mission is to defend the constitutional rights under the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions. Voting is not a privilege. It is a constitutional right. The right to vote is protected by more constitutional amendments, the 1st, 14th, 15th, 19th, and 26th amendments, than any other right that we enjoy as Americans. The fundamental constitutional right to vote is also protected by the Minnesota Constitution, as well as declarations by the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions that the right to vote is fundamental because it preserves all other political rights. A fundamental constitutional right is a right that cannot be taken away by the vote of a majority. This is well established and undisputed constitutional law. The voter ID bills before the committee today appear to violate this fundamental right under the federal constitution, the Minnesota constitution, as well as under Minnesota's election statutes. In 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld an Indiana voter ID law on the grounds that Indiana had a history of voting fraud and bloated, antiquated voter registration lists, and on the grounds that there was no evidence that voter ID law burdened any particular class of voter. Minnesota is not Indiana. First, the microscopic scrutiny of two election recounts in 2008 and 2010 have not led to a single conviction of voter impersonation fraud, the only type of voter fraud that voter ID can address. Our voter registration lists are by law updated monthly, automatically reflecting change of address and removal because of death. Minnesota has a proud history of clean elections and high voter turnout. Moreover, there were only 26 voting felony convictions out of 29 million voters. Contrast that minuscule serial number to the number of people who would be disenfranchised. And I see I'm running out of time. My full testimony has been provided to every member. I do want to also point out that Minnesota has 11 federally recognized Indian tribes, where Indiana has zero. This bill would implicate their right to vote. It would also implicate a consent decree that the ACLU of Minnesota and the NCAI obtained in 2005, requiring Minnesota to allow tribe members to vote using tribal ID that contains their photo but no address. And so we're very concerned about that issue. Therefore, we urge you to oppose House these voter ID bills. I just want to end by saying that supporters of Jim Crow justified their voter suppression laws as equal treatment of all voters. We urge you not to follow the rumors of blogs or the manufactured fear of fraud yet to come and vote no on this voter suppression bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Well, we will have Walter Hudson next, and again, please hold your any applause or whatnot. Okay, is Walter here? Okay, then we will move on to Lucky Rosenblum, and then after that, we'll hear from Deirdre Keyes. Is Deirdre here? Deirdre here? Okay. Okay, since you appear to be ready, we'll start with you, and then we'll go to Lucky Rosenblum. If you would like to state your name and your group you're representing for the tape.
Sure. My name is Deirdre Keyes, and I work at the Battered Women's Legal Advocacy Project. I've been an advocate working with victims of domestic violence for over 15 years. And I'm testifying today concerning vouching by an employee of a residential facility. We are very fortunate in our state to have residential facilities that house battered women when they are fearful of harm from a spouse or a boyfriend. Known in my field as safe housing or battered women's shelter, women who are victims of domestic abuse can stay there for their safety. While they are in safe housing, the women are required to make no contact with their former residents, and it is not likely that they will want to be anywhere near their old polling place for fear of being seen. They are in shelter because of their fear of imminent danger. In the news just yesterday, the Minnesota Femicide Report was released. There were 28 deaths in 2010 where people were killed, women, children, and men, in intimate partner homicides. Without battered women's shelter, this number would be higher. Come early November, during elections, these women are able to vote because of the vouching system. The staff of the shelter goes with the women to the shelter's precinct and vouches for their status as a resident of the shelter. At this point, these women are able to vote. If the option of vouching is removed, these women will not be able to vote. Their ability to exercise their right and privilege to vote would be removed. These women who are in fear for their lives should not be penalized because they are in circumstances beyond their control. I spoke with shelter managers yesterday and learned that all of the women who were eligible to vote in recent elections residing in shelter wanted to vote. They are interested in voting. Yet on election day, they were residents of the battered women's shelter with IDs stating the address of the residence they just fled. With the current vouching system in place, we are able to assist them to vote and be safe. If the vouching system were not in place, these women would choose safety over voting, and their voice would not be heard at the polling place. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lucky Rosenblum, and then Dell Erickson.
Thank you. My name is Lucky Rosenblum. I serve on the Governor's Council on Black Minnesotans. Well, I'm not here to speak for the Council on Black Minnesotans. I'm here to speak for what I believe is in the best interest in the black community and myself as an African American living in the state of Minnesota. When I go to the bank to cash my check, the lady behind the teller booth says, "Could I see your utility bill?" When I go to CVS and I write a check, I'm asked, "Can I see your utility bill?" When I go to SA, I write a check, I'm asked, "Can I see your utility bill?" I think you all know the joke I'm making behind that. I am always asked,
can I see your ID, which I always keep in my pocket. And most African Americans that I know, we always keep our ID in our pockets because we know if we get pulled over by the police, we're going to need it. Thank you. I got some laughs out there. Let me tell you why I think this is important. I teach civil rights and I teach history. I believe Minnesota voting ID is an enforcement of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Some of us know that during Reconstruction, when black people were trying to vote, they came up with all these loopholes. And these loopholes included things like grandfather clauses, literacy tests, and poll taxes. I went in to vote when I moved over to South Minneapolis. I went in to vote, and I did not have a utility bill because I just moved in my home, and I didn't have any bills coming yet. Thank God, because after you make that first mortgage payment, you don't want to see any bills right away. So I did not have a utility bill to show my current address. To me, not being able to vote that day because of a utility bill was similar to a poll tax, was similar to a literacy test, was similar to some kind of a grandfather clause. Understand that with Minnesota voter ID, when I walk in with my identification, no one can turn me down. No one can tell me, Lucky Rosenblum, you are not voting today because I have the ID in my pocket. Some people will say, well, you know, voter ID is going to have some kind of a negative impact on African Americans voting. I'm here to say, in my opinion, a utility bill is a loophole. That voter ID would empower me to vote. When Lyndon B. Johnson signed the 1965 Voting Rights Act, that was a powerful act. We need to pass this bill because it will empower people in my community. Pass the bill. I hold for some of people who have sat up here and said that people who are behind this bill may have some kind of a racist proclivity. I say for those of you who will not pass this bill, you need to ask yourself seriously if you're supporting one of these loopholes that kept black people from voting in the early 50s and 60s. Thank you.
If you could just wait a second, I do see that we have a burning member question, and I will take burning member questions only. So, Representative Simon.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be quick. Mr. Rosenblum, thanks for your testimony. My own father went through the same situation as you did in the 98 election. He had just moved in October and needed to go to the polling place in November. Couldn't someone have vouched for you?
Well,
you didn't have a utility bill and you didn't have a driver's license for your new address. Couldn't a neighbor that you had befriended under our current system said, this is Lucky, he's my neighbor, that's what my dad did?
Understand, I had just moved in to my residency. I didn't know anyone in that block yet. Had I had my ID and that law would be in effect, I could have voted. I didn't know anyone in that block.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rosenblum, I guess we've had some testimony here from, I can't remember her name, but the woman who was 94, and she talked about the fact that even if the state provides a free ID, you still have to get to the place that provides the free ID, and under Representative Kiffmeyer's bill, that is a DMV facility in the state. If you live in a rural area, that DMV facility might be very far from your home. If you're a woman who was married, say, 60 years ago, you've been voting for 60 years without problem, but and then you have to go and prove that you're with your birth certificate to get your photo ID, and the birth certificate, if you can get it, you have to pay for, and then you have to get a marriage certificate if your name has changed since that time, and you have to pay for those things. There's no provision in these bills for the state of Minnesota to pay for all the supporting documentation. And I guess my question is, if you have to get over the hurdle of getting yourself to a DMV facility that might be far from your home, you have to make contact with other states potentially or other counties which may not be automated and computerized to get these documents, and then you have to pay for them. Isn't that the same thing as a poll tax?
I suggest you come and learn something from the urban community. because in our community, we take care of our senior citizens. We will pick them up. We give them rides. We give them rides to the voting places. So maybe you need to come and learn from the urban community how you can best take care of your senior citizens to make sure that they're going to meet the things they need to do to get that ID to vote.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I just want to follow up the rest of my question, though. What about the cost of getting supporting documentation? If you have to pay $50 to get a birth certificate and a marriage license that may be from a rural county or from a different state, isn't that the same thing as
let
a
me respond by something Rosenblum. Let me respond by something I heard President Obama say just recently about the health care bill. Let's come together. Let's not throw it away, but let's come together, find out what we need to iron out, what we need to do to make this thing work, and make it work. If you have those kinds of concerns, I am sure that anyone that's going to sponsor this bill will sit down with you, and listen to those concerns, address those concerns, and make this bill to the point where it meets the needs of every person out there that legitimately would like to vote.
Madam Chair, we'll wait to see whether we'll be able to address every concern that we have with this bill.
Representative Nelson.
We shall see.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Rosenblum. I guess I just want a clarification. You said when you tried to vote, you didn't have a bill, you didn't have anyone to vouch for you. Had you already changed your driver's license? So was your ID at that current address that you just moved into?
No, I had not. I did not have a chance to change my driver's license because I had just moved from St. Paul to Minneapolis.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Rosenblum. So then, therefore, it wasn't the not having a bill. You still would not have been able to vote because you wouldn't have had a current.
Negative.
Representative.
Negative, because what they told me was that if I brought back a utility bill, I could vote. I was not told anything about having an ID. I was told to bring back a utility bill. By the way, my utility bills come in the name of Lucky Rosenblum, my nickname. My full given name is Maryland Rosenblum. If I had followed their criteria, I could have voted that day under Lucky Rosenblum. And if I was a criminal, I probably could have went back and voted again under Maryland Rosenblum. Which brings me up to something else. Some of you all would say, well, how do we know that there's not fraud that's occurring? Well, you know, I work for the criminal justice system. I doubt that we're going to have people that's going to come in here and tell you, hey, I voted fraudulently that day and risk being charged with a felony.
Okay. We're satisfied. Okay, let's thank you, Mr. Rosenblum. We'll move on to Dell Erickson, and then if we could have the speakers from MPIRG in line. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you. Earlier, Representative
I'm sorry, please state your name.
My name is Dell Erickson. I live in Brooklyn Center. Thank you. Representative Benson, in his introductory commentary, pretty much said what the things I was going to talk about today. So I will just add two quick notes. First, it's been in the last 10 or 15, maybe a little more years, that the integrity of the system has been called into question, and the result has been this bill. Is one of the reasons is for this bill is that it's happened, and the citizens are now looking for a way to correct that. The second thing that I want to mention is that previous speakers have been talking about residency as if that were the same thing as citizenship. And we have to remember that when we talk about Constitution and we talk about residency, that the two are separate. So on the one hand, we have to first identify yourself as a citizen, and then you have to provide some kind of documentation of where you may live. And the reason where you live is important is not so much for the larger offices, but the local offices at the city council area, at the people's area, at the representative area. You need to know where the people live. But first and primarily, you have to know if you are eligible to vote because you are a citizen. And I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you so much. We have some folks from MPIRG. And then on deck, we'll have Kathy Bonifield. Are you here, Kathy? Welcome to the committee. Before you start your testimony, if you could just restate your name for the record and your organization.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Butler, and I am a co-chair of the McAllister chapter of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, or MPIRG. MPIRG is a student-directed organization that represents 8 colleges across Minnesota working on issues of social and environmental justice. As a student who is studying here from out of state and as an election judge in both 2008 and 2010, I would like to share how this bill would significantly burden college students' ability to vote. I live in Minnesota over 300 days of the year, and laws here are what have a direct influence on my everyday life. However, House File Bill 89 will discourage myself and the other 20,161 out-of-state students on MPIRG chapter campuses to vote, because we will need to go out of our way to get an ID that will make us eligible to do so. Under the new House File 210 language, out-of-state voters will be unable to vote absentee because they do not have a Minnesota driver's license or ID card, which again limits students' ability to vote. The only information I have to verify my off-campus residence is the internet bill I receive. But my roommates are not so lucky. None of them receive bills in their name, and as a result, I must vouch for their residence. In the 2010 primary, I was able to vouch for them, which was the only way they would be able to vote. This can be an even bigger problem for married couples who need to re-register at a new address, as I saw working at the polls. Also, with this system, college students that live on campus would be relying on colleges to provide their resident halls list. However, private schools are not required to do this and leave students reliant upon something they can't control. I saw firsthand the difficulty and frustration of students who tried to engage in the democratic process when school was out of session during the 2010 primary in August. They found out rather abruptly that most students are essentially no longer allowed to vote in primary elections in Minnesota. House File Bill 89 and House File Bill 210 will be doing the same thing to students in the general election. We should be encouraging citizenship, not limiting it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Peter Randall. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm also active in MPIRG. As a student, I am prone to being transient. I went to University of Iowa my freshman year and moved back to Minnesota. In those 3.5 years, I have changed residency 5 times and my license once. As Representative Benson pointed out, you need a license or an ID to buy cigarettes or tobacco or alcohol, but the difference is this is a privilege, not a right. I am not uncommon in my transientness. There are many more students who frequently change during these years. As a result, the provisions of HF 89 would make it difficult for many eligible and, may I add, very busy with school and work students to vote, as they have limited time and resources to update their IDs in the month and a half prior to election. Youth in this nation are already hard to reach out and engage as active citizens. There is no need for more barriers that jeopardize Minnesota's nation-leading youth voter turnout. Although an improvement over House File 89, House File 210 uses a fee statement along with student ID for students to register and vote, but the same principle still remains, an addition of barriers to the fundamental American right of voting. This may not even fix the problem. My fee statement does have a current address on it, however, this was a recent change. As other students can attest, many fee statements do not contain their current address, but rather the address of their parents or previous address. Did an informal poll of students at St. Catherine University, and only 1 of 15 had a current address on their fee statement. At the barest minimum, this poses serious questions about how effectively these provisions will be in maintaining the right of eligible students to vote. And the use of provisional ballots as a backup is filled with problems. The people without ID at voting time are unlikely to have it within 5 working days. If thousands of students came to the county auditor, would the office be able to handle that? How do we properly inform citizens of these new ID requirements so they do not need a provisional ballot? This new process seems very time and energy consuming response to a phantom problem of a pervasive vote fraud.
Thank you very much. Next we have Kathy Bonifield, and then on deck we have Laura Norlander and with Jeanette Gudgel at the same time. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your association for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Kathy Bonifield, and I'm the Associate Director of Citizens for Election Integrity Minnesota. I'm also an international election observer with the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe. And finally, I have been an election judge since 2003 here in Minnesota. I will be back if you need me on Tuesday to answer any questions. I'm here today to speak about the report I co-wrote with Carol Johnson. The report, Facts About Ineligible Voting and Voter Fraud, is based on a survey we sent out to all county attorneys. As noted in the report, over 80% of Minnesota county attorneys, representing over 90% of the 2008 voters, responded to our survey. We decided to research this issue of photo ID, because we had heard others wanted to institute a photo ID requirement to vote because of a concern, but it seemed there was no specific case. We knew that the Brennan Center had conducted research, and it identified that someone was more likely to be killed by a lightning strike than to commit the type of fraud a photo ID requirement would prevent. We had also heard that Fritz Knack, the lead attorney for the Coleman recount in 2008, he stated that they were looking for fraud, but they couldn't find it. We had heard this already, but we decided to go and do our own research to find out if they were wrong. I would also like to point out, in recent weeks, we learned that two of the three former Minnesota Secretaries of State, Arlen Erdahl and Joan Groh, approved all the recommendations in the report. The specific recommendation I'm here to discuss today is the recommendation not to institute a photo ID requirement to vote in Minnesota. Before I talk about the survey results, I would like to point out that right after the introduction of that report, we do not leap into the survey, but we leap into the safeguards that are in place. Those safeguards review whether a person who has already voted or someone that registered to vote on election day was eligible to vote. In regards to the survey results, I would like to point out that county attorneys reported over 1,500 investigations. Those investigations were both internally triggered and externally triggered. Portions of those externally triggered investigations were prompted by an organization that only had access to what is called the public voter list, which does not include some identifying information such as the exact birth date. It is unknown how many false positives that group provided to county attorneys, but some county attorneys did report they found false positives. The Anoka County attorney reported that they investigated cases of double voting, meaning that more than one person voted, but what they found out, or one person more than voted more than once, but their investigations found out that there was two people that had the same names and same birth dates. The Dakota County attorney reported that 35% of their investigations were determined not to be chargeable because they were investigating a suspect that actually had a gross misdemeanor, meaning he had the right to vote or she had the right to vote, or there was never a felony conviction, or that the felony conviction's time had been served. The only type of conviction, I want to make sure that this is clear, was either felons who had voted or felons who registered to vote. It wasn't 39 people who voted, it was 26 felons who had voted. 12 people were convicted because they were registering to vote and they had felony convictions. So to look at the 26 people who voted compared to the 2008 people who had voted as well, that is 9/10,000ths of 1% of all the voters were convicted of fraud and they were all felonies. A photo ID will not prevent that. I know that I'm running out of time, but I want to show you something that we've been talking about. In this, I called someone in Iowa and I said, I want to see what a provisional ballot envelope looks like. This is what a provisional ballot envelope is. I'm an election judge and I was really happy when we got rid of absentee ballot envelopes in the precinct. By passing any photo ID law, you are bringing these back to the precincts. And then you're going to have people argue about, were they filled out correctly? We all learned in 2008 that the absentee ballot should be taken to the county seat and not in the precincts. Think clearly about what you're doing with provisional ballots. Thank you.
Are you Laura?
I am.
Okay. If you could just state your name again for the tape and who you're with.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Laura Norlander, and I'm an election judge in Woodbury, Minnesota.
This was my first time to be an election judge in 2010, so I just recently went through the training. And it was also rather kind of an eye-opener to receive the training and realize how many opportunities there are for fraud in our system. I was quite stunned by this, and when I was explaining it to my family and friends, I think everyone felt that our system was not as secure as they thought. My first observation was as a roster judge. I was told that if someone came, they just state their name, and there's no identification required. They can also verify their address. They are allowed to sign without ever proving who they actually are. If later in the election, someone else comes and claims that they are that same person, we were told that the procedure is to also allow that person to sign the roster and make a notation on a log that describes discrepancies. So both voters would be allowed to vote under that same name. I was stunned by this procedure that we would not verify who people are, even if they're pre-registered. My second observation was the vouching system. Essentially, that's a system based on oaths, which much of the election system that we use is based on oaths. That is really great if everyone is honest. But if there are enough dishonest people using the system, it can throw an election easily. What I noticed about the vouching is that even the person who's doing the vouching, they are not required to prove who they are. They just are saying that they're a registered voter, they find their name on the roster, and their number of their registration is the only proof that is on the election day registration. That's stunning to me. You have two people that do not have to prove their identification to allow up to 15 people to vote under that. I think that's startling, and I think we need to correct that situation. I think as a citizen, we have a responsibility to keep our birth certificate current, our marriage certificate current, and a photo ID current. We live in the United States of America. The technology that we use is just amazing, and I think we should take Minnesota to a place where we can use that technology for the benefit to make sure that there's one vote per voter, and that it's a legitimate, eligible vote. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I understand there's someone who's in desperate need to be somewhere else, so if you don't mind, we'll have Melvin Carter before we have Jeanette Gudgel. Again, please state your name and
thank you.
Who you're with for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Melvin Carter. I am a member of the St. Paul City Council, where I represent Ward 1, which we're not too far from today. I'm speaking today on behalf of the unanimous St. Paul City Council, as well as Mayor Chris Coleman, as well as the 300,000 people that we collectively represent. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Today's topic is one that I can't take lightly. If I could trace my own personal mission back to one moment in time, it's being wrongfully turned away from a Tallahassee, Florida polling location as a student at Florida A&M University during election 2000. To this day, that was the most profound feeling of powerlessness I've ever experienced in my life. We came to vote feeling empowered and hopeful, but left feeling embarrassed, upset, and helpless. More than anything, I felt confused. I grew up hearing about from my parents and grandparents about poll taxes and other such measures we once employed to prevent Americans from voting, but I knew that those things were behind us. I believed then, and I believe today, in the words our founding fathers used so carefully to open their Declaration of Independence. This country was built on the premise that governments truly do derive their power from the consent of the governed. I was confused in Florida because I couldn't figure out how to reconcile that promise with the unwelcoming experience that I and so many of my classmates felt when we tried to vote that day. I'm here today because I'm similarly confused by these efforts. We heard testimony today that you need a photo ID to do things such as buy alcohol or take an ACT or to write a check at CVS, as though those things are anywhere in comparison to the fundamental right to vote. I'm confused just the same way by how we can declare that we need elections to be free and fair while proposing a poll tax. And yes, to answer to your question, which wasn't answered earlier, was yes, these things are subsequent to a poll tax. You know, our politics will lead us to different conclusions at different times, but we should always agree that every American eligible voter should be more than welcome at the polls, and that no eligible voter should ever again know how awful it feels to be denied their fundamental right to vote. I'm here today because this bill could do just that. Our process works. We constantly lead the nation in voter turnout, and I've never heard of anyone in Minnesota trying to vote under someone else's name. Requiring photo ID is not only an unnecessary waste of scarce public resources and another unfunded mandate on local governments who are already struggling, it's a barrier that could result in countless Minnesotans being denied their right to vote simply because they couldn't afford a driver's license. We've heard from some of those people today already. I've never been prouder of Minnesota than when Tom Emmer announced his decision to concede the 2010 governor's race instead of subjecting the state to a costly, protracted legal challenge for political gain. I know that had to be a tough personal decision for him to make, but it was a strong declaration. Our state is too good to play politics with democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Next we have Jeanette Gudgel, and then on. Then next we'll have Andrew Spaeth. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to have this opportunity.
Okay, please
step. My name is Jeanette Gudgel, and I've been an election judge for some 20 years in four different St. Paul precincts. I'm presently head election judge in a working class blue-collar precinct. I am sorry that you have not had the opportunity of seeing the video, which I did have. And so many of my statements are going to be based on that, assuming that you would have seen it. The 21st Century Voting ID is the proposal in the House File 210, and it's an important innovation. Because it helps precincts, it will be very much easier for those of us who are election judges. But I want to focus on one thing today, which is the provisional ballots. We sometimes have to turn away people because they don't have the proper documentation or because someone can't vouch for them. Provisional ballots will afford everyone the opportunity to cast a ballot. Now they have to show their ID and more time and more documentation. They will need, if they have a provisional ballot, they will need to do that later. I believe it's within 10 days. Wisconsin, I believe, has that system now. I don't see provisional ballots being a problem at the local precinct. They are collected, however the planning will be. But the county will take care of those in the same way that they take care of absentee ballots. When I look at the years, about either none to four people are turned away each election time because they don't have someone or have the proper documentation. So you're probably looking at somewhere between 200 and 400 provisional ballots that the county will need to handle. Now, the idea of, let's talk about elderly citizens being disenfranchised. Anyone can get that state ID at 65 years and older. It does not need to be renewed, and the photo ID does not need to be renewed. It will be updated by mail. As a team member, I often go into nursing homes and collect absentee ballots. And as I understand it, that same system will work under the 21st Century Voter ID. Finally, I must tell you that most of the voters in my precinct come with their ID in hand, and they expect to show it. And when they're told it's not needed, they're surprised and often irritated. Voters expect integrity in our elections. With that, thank you so much for the opportunity of testifying today.
Thank you very much. Let's have Jeffrey Ditburner and Oh, I'm sorry. We already announced we're going to have Andrew Spaeth, and then we'll have Jeffrey Ditburner after him.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Andrew Spaeth's replacement. I'm also from the MSUSA, Minnesota State University Student Association. My name is Matt Smiriga, S-M-R-I-G-A. I am the Director of Campus Organizing for the organization. And I work directly with the students on the seven state university campuses within MNSCU. Every 2 years, our statewide student association engages in a robust get-out-the-vote effort on our state university campuses. We spend time and resources on this work because we believe it is important, in matter of fact, essential for students to participate in the political process. Many students are first-time voters, and it is essential that the processes to register and vote are as accessible as possible to these students. There's a lot of research that shows that people who vote during the college years are much more likely to continue that habit of civic engagement for the rest of their lives in comparison to those who don't. Minnesota has long led the country in voter participation, and that is something that we should all be proud of and continue to support. To do that, it is essential that we are as inclusive as possible to voters who have the legal right to vote. Today, our students can use their student ID as a photo ID during the voting process. Using another form of photo ID would make it more difficult for our students to vote. A student's driver's license is most likely has his or her permanent address on it, and a separate voter ID card would be difficult to obtain for many students with limited transportation options. In addition, it is important for students to be able to use documents other than student fee statements to prove residency in a precinct, because those fee statements also likely only have a student's permanent address on it. That's an important point. Finally, we are concerned about the cost of this proposed legislation. At a time when the state faces a significant budget deficit and a great deal of discussion will certainly occur as we move forward about the cuts that need to be made in areas including higher education, it will be important to prioritize state's funding. Today's students are tomorrow's educated citizens and workers. It is essential that we engage them today to ensure that Minnesota continues to lead the country in voter participation. If we make it more difficult for them to vote now, what message are we sending to them about our desire for them to be active and engaged citizens of the future? Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I think we're going to go 10 minutes over. We'll adjourn today at about 12:10, because that's over our committee time. We will take three more people. We'll take Jeffrey Ditburner. We'll take Andy Selick and Todd Huft. Then we will conclude on Tuesday, bring the authors back. They will we'll take up Representative Kiffmeyer's bill after the conclusion of the witnesses. Let her play the video. We will take up her bill first with amendments and questions on members, followed by Representative Benson's bill. So with that, if you could please proceed, state your name and who you are with for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify this morning. My name is Jeff Ditburner. I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota State College Student Association, representing students of Minnesota's public two-year community and technical colleges. Encouraging civic engagement is one of our association's top priorities. America's young people tend to vote well below the national average, a trend that we work very hard to combat. This fall alone, our students conducted a statewide get-out-the-vote effort that registered thousands of students from colleges all across the state. We learned that our students do care deeply about the future of our state and democracy. However, the electoral process often seems confusing and inaccessible to many, especially when students are new to a campus community. Further, we learned that many students do not make the decision to vote until just days before an election. It is for these reasons that we are concerned about some of the provisions contained in Representative Kiffmeyer's bill. We appreciate the representative's efforts to protect the integrity of our elections, but we'd like to offer our input as to how to achieve this goal without making it more difficult for eligible student voters to exercise their most fundamental right of American democracy. To cut my time down shorter, the two provisions, mostly what we're looking to see is an expansion of the use of documents to prove residence, especially for the section that contains that students have to show a fee statement. We'd like to expand that to include other documents. Today's students are the future of our state and our country. We must ensure that they feel encouraged to vote and be engaged citizens if we are to continue to enjoy the robust democracy we have today. I fear that if this bill, as written, becomes law, far too many Minnesota students will be dissuaded from exercising their right to vote in their chosen communities. I feel confident that our suggestions will make the bill more student-friendly while maintaining Representative Kiffmeyer's intention of ensuring the utmost integrity in our elections. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you so much. We have Andy Selick. The final witness of the day will be Todd Huff. And then we do have one member question. I'd ask a member to wait to hold off until the end for a question. And that'll be how we wrap up today. So if you could proceed and state your name and your
Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Selick. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Voters Alliance. First, I just want to express my sincere thanks to Representatives Kiffmeyer and Benson for working so hard to get this photo ID bill moving forward to ultimate passage. I heard the military mentioned. I am a former United States Marine. My father was also a Marine. He wasn't as lucky as I was because he spent time in Chosin Reservoir in Korea. I believe the right to vote is an absolute fundamental right, and every single vote must be protected. Anytime an illegitimate vote is counted, a legitimate voter is disenfranchised. I heard college students get up here and talk. I'm also a former college student. I couldn't help but think we have people in other countries, Iraq, Afghanistan, under fire, don't know if they're going to live through the night, and we have college students that can't get a photo ID to vote. It's just something doesn't sit right with me. Something that Representative Simon said about vouching for your neighbors, the U.S. Supreme Court said this: in the old days and in small towns where everyone knew each other, voters did not need to identify themselves. But in the United States, where 40 million people move each year, and in urban areas where some people don't even know the people living in their own apartment building, let alone their precinct, some form of identification is needed. The electoral system cannot inspire public confidence if no safeguards exist to detect or deter voter fraud. We had 23,000 ballots or votes counted due to provisional postal verification cards coming back, and we're not going to go after and check those people till after the election. We think that people's vote shouldn't count unless they prove their identity before the election. And to touch on Melvin Carter's statement about consent of the governed, this is 3,000 notarized signatures from St. Paul residents. So I think Melvin Carter's on the wrong end of that one. Please,
I just want to wait because the audios get screwed up and we're not able to record it properly. If somebody's got a phone on, please shut it off so we can finish up here. Okay, were you done?
I want to just make one last comment. Thank you very much. The League of Women Voters were the sole plaintiffs in the Indiana case. By the way, 4-1, the Indiana Supreme Court upheld photo ID. Three of those were appointed by Democrats. But here's what they said. They said no individual voter has challenged that the voting ID law prevented him or her from voting or inhibited his or her ability to vote in any way. I think that the charges made by opponents are frivolous and unwarranted. And the U.S. Supreme Court said a photo ID is minimal and justified. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Final testifier for the day, Todd Huff.
Hi, my name is Todd Haft. I was an election judge for the first time in Rochester, Minnesota, where I live. A lot of the things I was going to go over have already been said, but basically, as I served as an election judge, primarily I was doing registration, and most of the delays that happened were due to documentation, people had changed their names, various other problems. Most of the people that came to the table already had their driver's license out and ready, and actually for me that made things much easier. I didn't have to worry about spelling or pronunciation of names, verifying addresses. Everything was in black and white. Check it off, you're done. It was much slower when you had to verify everything. And I also think that in this day and age, when they talk about vouching, if we lived in a earlier time where you could rely on the honesty of everybody, that would be much more simple. However, I don't think that's the case now. Also, I don't think the current election rules, even with such thing as utility bill, addresses the ability for people to create documents at will and change whatever name may be on them. Any motivated group or individual would certainly be able to print numerous utility bills with several different names on them. Overall, I think this is a good idea. I think that the many of the complaints about the time it takes, and it's like election day is sneaking up on them. I'm pretty sure it's at the same time every time. So it probably isn't a big surprise when it's going to happen. I realize it might be a problem for some people, but I think if you have a two-year warning, you could probably get it done. That's about all I have, and thank you for listening.
Thank you. At this time, I think we will. I would like to call back up Jessica Peterson White. A member has a question for you on your earlier testimony. Okay, I'm going to do this. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White, I was pleased that you took the, you know, your precinct is well run. You care about the integrity. I just had a clarification. When you reconciled, what was the delta in your precinct?
You mean what was the difference between our receipts and our ballots?
Yeah, as statutorily defined.
It was perfect.
So there was no discrepancy whatsoever?
No.
Okay, thank you.
At this time, I know that there are just a few more people, but I think at this time I'd like to see if there are any other questions that the members desire of the witnesses that we had, that we've had so far. Okay. Should I do these now? Is there a Justin Page and a Nikki Villanvenicio here from the Disability Law Center? Do you need to testify today? So you'd read previously on our list. Do you have one person or two to testify? Okay, I think we'll take you then as the last one, and then we'll have finished off that part of the list that we'd already promised. And then we'll adjourn until Tuesday. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Thank you, committee members. My name is Justin Page, and I am an attorney with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. The Disability Law Center is part of the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. We represent individuals with significant disabilities throughout the state. We have serious concerns with portions of House File 210 and its potential impact on individuals with disabilities. First, individuals with disabilities have the right to vote. And if that person needs a personal assistance in order to vote, he is entitled to have a personal assistant to vote. And that personal assistant can be someone of his or her own choosing. That is what federal law requires, and that is current state law. Now, I know the language in House File 210 is going to change on this, and I understand that there's a recognition that the Voting Rights Act specifically requires individuals with disabilities who need assistance, that they're able to choose who can provide assistance to them, unless it's one of their employers or the voter's agent. So I'll withhold comment until I see further language on that, but I appreciate the fact that the language is going to be changed. We are also concerned with provisions of the bill that eliminate vouching for individuals in residential facilities such as veterans homes, nursing homes, and group homes. Elimination of vouching for individuals in residential facilities will significantly increase the barriers that individuals with disabilities face when voting and make it much more difficult to vote. Finally, we are also concerned with regard to the photo ID requirement. Roughly 10% of individuals with disabilities do not have a photo ID that would allow them to vote, and they face significant barriers in getting one. It's been individuals with disabilities who do not drive and may have trouble getting transportation to a government office to get an ID. House File 210 provides that the cost of obtaining a photo ID will be paid for by the government if the individual cannot afford it. However, the supporting documents, such as getting an ID card, can be costly and time-consuming for individuals to track down. And finally, I want to make a comment on there was a lot of talk about how voting is a civic duty and we should all be able to vote. I've read the amended House File 210 this morning, which specifically prohibits individuals under guardianship from voting. It's hard for me to believe that you can talk about a civic engagement or civic duty to vote while at the same time disenfranchising a whole group of people. Thank you.
Thank you. And that will wrap up our testimony for today. There's a few people that did ask to, that just got put on the list today. We will allow for those people that had already given their name an opportunity to speak on Tuesday. Please, members, remember that we will be taking amendments only through noon on Monday. With that, I will adjourn the meeting.